You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2013 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. For the last several weeks, we've watched our president struggle with whether or not to use force as a threat on a country on the other side of the globe. Tonight, we'll hear about another president from years ago, Woodrow Wilson, whose re-election slogan was, "He kept us out of the war," but in whose second term, he committed the U.S. to participate in World War I. After Wilson won that vote in Congress to enter World War I, according to Scott Berg, he went back to his office in the White House, put his head on the table, and wept. These are the details of foreign policy we rarely get to see. But in his extraordinary and astute new biography of Wilson, 8 years of research, 2 years of writing, Scott Berg offers a comprehensive understanding of the man and the presidency. In his witty profile of Scott in the September Los Angeles magazine, David Kippen writes, "Wilson was a tragic hero with strictness, both his moral center and tragic flaw, majestic, idealistic, frail, unyielding, absolutist. Berg's Wilson is less Jesus than Lear with a little Quixote thrown in." Scott Berg is also the author of a Pulitzer Prize-winning biography of Charles Lindbergh, as well as the epic life of film producer Samuel Goldwyn, his biography of editor Maxwell Perkins, editor of both Fitzgerald and Hemingway, won a National Book Award, and his biography of his friend, the late Katharine Hepburn, is a classic. And I can attest to how focused Scott is on his writing when he was here to interview Jim Newton not so long ago for Jim's biography of Eisenhower. Scott had to leave immediately after the program so he could get home and get back to his writing. We were extremely lucky to pull him away from his desk for a few hours, but now he's on tour, he's on the road with his wonderful book, and switching roles with Scott tonight as interviewer, we're delighted that Jim Newton, editor-at-large for the Los Angeles Times, can join us. Jim is the author of two biographies, Justice for All, Earl Warren and the Nation He Made, and an entirely new reappraisal of our first post-World War II president, Ike Eisenhower, the White House years. So please welcome Jim Newton and A. Scott Berg. Thank you.
Well, before we begin, we're going to have one more person talk before Scott gets to say anything. I'd just like to begin on a little note of personal privilege here, if you don't mind. One of the most welcome benefits to me in the last decade or so of my book writing life has been the opportunity it's been given me to get to know Scott. As Louise just mentioned, we've appeared on some panels together, we've presented some awards, and Scott was kind enough to interview me here a couple of years ago when my Ike book came out. So it's a real treat to be on stage with someone I regard as my friend. But even more than that, it's really an honor to be up here with one of the nation's most accomplished writers. There is no finer biographer at work in this country today than Scott Berg. In fact, he's had impact and influence that I suspect he doesn't even know. Take, for example, again, as Louise mentioned, his biography of Max Perkins, editor of Genius. For a number of years now, I've assigned editor of Genius to young editors at the Los Angeles Times in the hope that they would grasp what it meant to edit, the possibilities of the craft. So when you read stories in the Times, at least the well-edited ones, you have a debt to Scott. And then there is his biography of Lindbergh, again, as Louise mentioned, justifiably celebrated, it's deservedly honored, it earned Scott a Pulitzer. It is also among the books that have helped one author in particular, namely me. In those really trying moments that every author knows and Scott knows all too well, when the story seems too complex or the sentence structure is just too tangled, my recourse over the past many years has been simply to go to the shelf and pull down Lindbergh and read. It is, for me, a source of genuine inspiration. Nobody writes like you.
Thank you.
So, While I'm glad to be able to share this evening with my friend, I am really, truly honored to be here with a great American writer, and I thank you, Scott.
I thank you very much.
With that, let's talk about Woodrow
no,
Wilson.
Carry on.
What do you
You're
say?
Doing great. That was, I don't know about you, I was loving it.
the question I know you're asked most often, because I read it in your excerpt in Vanity Fair, why Wilson? Well, why don't we start there?
Why Wilson? Yes, Woodrow Wilson was inaugurated 100 years ago this year, and I felt that he was just slipping between the cracks, among other things. He's not among the forgotten presidents yet, but for somebody who for decades was in the top four or five presidents, right after Washington, Jefferson, and Lincoln, really, and now there's been a lot of slippage. So that's one reason. The second is, and it's a two-part reason, one part of that is I believe Woodrow Wilson was the most influential president of the 20th century, and that influence is still slipping into the 21st century, and I'm sure we will talk about the reasons I feel that. The second thing is there is no president whose personal life has been more dramatic than Woodrow Wilson's, and it's a story that really hasn't been told. And I thought it would be interesting to write the life of a president from the inside out. Most biographies of presidents talk about the great figure who did such and such and then passed this act and did this, and oh, by the way, he had three daughters and you know, this and this happened. And I thought, what about starting and building this man from his ancestors up, seeing all the elements, all the DNA that went into him, see what his childhood was like, such that by the time he gets to the White House, you will be so informed how he was so informed, and you'll understand every choice he made. So in other words, I wanted to write a deeply personal presidential biography. And then the answer to your question is that when I was 15, I read a book about Woodrow Wilson and, well, sort of fell madly in love with him. And that's that. And he has never left my side. Woodrow Wilson's picture has been on my wall since I was in high school. No matter where I was, he was always with me. And after I had finished Lindbergh and was beginning to think about whom I would write next, all roads kept leading to Woodrow Wilson. I thought, I think I'm old enough now, wise enough to deal with him, but not too old that I still had enough energy to take on a president. Mm-hmm. So,
and as you started, obviously the many biographies already had been written about yes. Wilson. What is it that persuaded you that there was something more to find that just wasn't already out there?
Well, because I had this infatuation as a teenager with Wilson, I had been reading everything about Wilson that I could find since that time. So, I mean, I'd say there are thousands of books about Wilson. I can't say I've read the thousands, but I've certainly read many hundreds, maybe even into the thousands, though. And when you do all that reading, there's a photograph that develops in your mind of who the character is. And I kept thinking, but I'm not seeing a book that captures that essence, that captures that photograph. And so it may be the most hubristic thing a biographer thinks or says, but I said to myself, I think I have something new to say about Woodrow Wilson. And it was largely this personal portrait that I felt had not been presented, that the classic image of Wilson is this very dour, a Presbyterian minister's son and grandson and great-grandson. And nobody had ever captured the passion, the emotion, the joy. I mean, this was a really full-bodied guy, and that was nowhere in any of the books. Mm-hmm. The story we heard in the introduction, almost every book on Wilson tells you about that Declaration of War speech about making the world safe for democracy and so forth. But almost nowhere do you get the punchline, which is that Wilson then goes back to the White House and sobs and is angry that they cheered this speech about going to war. That so infuriated him. And yet, you know, that's the story I wanted to capture.
Mm-hmm. And so, that, I must say, before coming to your book, my sense of him was sort of the high stiff collar, Presbyterian, very sort of erect and aloof almost.
Yes.
And yet, talk about his love letters. Really, a whole different Wilson just comes pouring forth from those.
Even I was shocked. And I was giving the guy a break. But when he's courting his first wife, and because he really didn't have enough money, they couldn't get married right away. And so they had to go a couple of years of being engaged. Wilson and his fiancée, one Ellen Axon from Rome, Georgia, carried on a correspondence that went into the thousands of letters. They are among the most passionate love letters ever written. I mean, they are physical, they are emotional, they are intellectual.
They're almost
embarrassing to read. Well, they really are. And you know, I mean, sometimes they'd be 15, 20-page letters. I mean, just say I love you and go to bed, you know? I mean, let's call it a night. But these just went on and on and on. And I mean, they really did get sickening after a while. It was one of the hardest things in doing the book, actually, was just finding the greatest hits from these letters. But he was relentless. And then, as is part of the Wilson story, this woman with whom he was madly in love died her first year in the White House. And so now here is this president so utterly distraught, he can barely get out of bed. He sinks into a deep depression. The only thing that got him out of bed was, in fact, duty, because a war had just broken out in Europe that we came to call World War I, and he felt he had to do something. And then, almost magically, he would say providentially, he met a young widow in Washington, and within a year, met her, courted her, wrote her hundreds of letters, insanely passionate love letters, and married her. So there you go.
Right. And that set of insanely passionate love letters were while he's president of the United States.
While he's president of the United States. And yes, writing these letters, I mean, the Lusitania is going down, literally, and he is writing three letters a day trying to woo this woman. And the world doesn't know any of this is happening. And he's starting to give speeches where he can't even pay attention to what he's saying anymore. He is so besotten with this woman. and finally, you know, for the sake of the world, she marries him.
It took him, gave him back a lot of time.
Well, exactly.
And how is it, side note, how is it that all these letters are preserved?
Well, all these people, of course, you know, people wrote real letters then, and letters were worth keeping. And a lot of them were you know, just tucked away in trunks and so forth. And actually, apropos of that, and this is still sort of boggles my mind, because here I am writing 100 years after Woodrow Wilson was president. And 7 or 8 years ago, two different trunkloads of papers were discovered, personal papers, one within the Wilson family that was found in an attic in Massachusetts that belonged to, actually the letters were really from one of Woodrow Wilson's daughters. Nobody had seen these thousands of family letters. And then Wilson had a physician and intimate friend, one Dr. Grayson, Dr. Carrie T. Grayson, and his last son died. And in going through his garage, they found another trunk load of endless notes that the doctor took every day of his famous patient's health. Mm-hmm. So just intimate detail, again, personalizing mm-hmm. this man. And the doctor, I mean, literally had his finger on the pulse of the president.
Mm-hmm. Right. I want to back up a little bit and get back to the White House, of course, in a minute. But extraordinarily unusual route to the presidency. Really, no one ever quite like it. As you point out in the book, he's the only president ever to have a PhD, among other things. I wonder if you'd talk for a few minutes about the odd route that it took to the presidency and how that shaped the kind of politician and public figure that he became as a result.
It is an odd route, and it is an interesting. In fact, it's a unique route. Wilson is the only man who came to the White House through academia. Don't tell me Dwight Eisenhower is the president of Columbia now.
I wasn't going to try.
Okay. And LBJ did teach school for a while. But Wilson, and this is the staggering thing about Woodrow Wilson, I think. I mean, this may be the most interesting detail about Wilson. That in October of 1910, Woodrow Wilson, college professor, only PhD, blah, 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 was the president of a small men's college in New Jersey called Princeton. October 1910. It was a small school. You know, I mean, it was 1,000 rich men. In November of 1912, okay, from October 1910, November 1912, he's elected president of the United States. This is just staggering. And the root was, he had become a public intellectual. He wrote a dozen books. He delivered speeches all over the country on all sorts of themes, ranging from education to politics. He reformed, literally reformed, higher education in this country. If you went to a college or know someone who went to a college in which you majored in something, took some elective courses, maybe had two lectures a week and a class, maybe had an honor code, maybe there was a sequence of courses within your major. Those are all Woodrow Wilson ideas. That is the Wilsonian model that he introduced to American higher education, which is obviously with us to this day. And so people began to notice this Woodrow Wilson figure, kind of a low buzz, but people began to notice. But who did notice were the Democratic machine in New Jersey. And this was the most corrupt machine in the most corrupt state in America. And they said, we need a puppet. And why don't we go after that guy at Princeton, you know? I mean, what does he know? And so they picked him. They ran him as the Democratic puppet. He won in a big election. It was kind of great. He got into office. The first thing he did was kick out the machine. They are stupefied. But more important than that, everybody in the country is now saying, who is this? And then over the next 18 months, Wilson passed the most progressive agenda in the country. Mm-hmm. So within that, you know, 20-month period or whatever, suddenly this giant was born. This politician was unleashed.
It's almost impossible to imagine today anyone replicating that kind of rise to the presidency.
I cannot imagine it.
Yeah,
It really is extraordinary. Mm-hmm. Really is extraordinary. And here's the most extraordinary aspect of it, I think. It was based on ideas. It was a guy who had ideas. They were new ideas. In fact, he would say not ideas, but ideals. And he often talked about the difference between ideas and ideals. And that's what he did when he was running and when he was governor and then ultimately president. And he did it in such a way, he did it with a kind of eloquence that the country had never been exposed to before. And it was kind of lovely that this PhD, who was an expert in American politics and government and history, would give speeches. He never dumbed them down.
Yeah.
He never simplified the ideas. He never cheapened the vocabulary. And in so doing, everybody who listened to him felt better. They were elevated. And especially the least educated admired him the most. Mm-hmm. Because they felt better for Woodrow Wilson.
His campaign, that first campaign, almost feels like a lecture series in a
certain way. It truly is. And America loved it. Mm-hmm. And they were getting back to some real values that they loved. And the values were largely about leveling the playing field in this country. And that's what his administration, which was called the New Freedom, it was about economic freedom. And that's what Woodrow Wilson was selling. And that's what progressivism was for him. It was really equal opportunity. Mm-hmm. And that's what he fought for when he was the president of Princeton, trying to make it something other than a country club for rich men's sons. And that's what he did as president.
And he really redefined the progressivism of Teddy Roosevelt, who, by the way, comes off rather badly. I said,
thank you very much.
Yes.
Thank you.
And
I think he's kind of bogus.
Well, yeah, there's a kind of bully, childish quality to him in this book, right? But talk about how Wilson sort of adapts progressivism and really presents, as you say, this new vision of it, a democratic vision, a vision, academic vision in certain ways. What is that? Those first couple of years of his presidency where he was so successful.
He was so successful, and to be fair, he did have a Democratic Congress when he first came in, so that helped a lot. But Wilson did something really extraordinary. He changed the way presidents function in this country on many levels. The first of which was, he being a scholar of the Constitution and the American system, he believed that the Congress had become way too powerful. The legislature was way too important. And half of the legislature was in the pockets of a half dozen millionaires in this country. The presidency, as he pointed out, is the least defined office in the Constitution. Very little is said about what the president does and who he is. And Wilson's notion was, aha, I can use that. In other words, I can do whatever I want as president until somebody says, no, you can't do that. And that's basically what he did. And he did it by, well, it's actually what I try to do with the book. He tried to humanize the office. He didn't believe government was built on institutions, but people who worked within the institutions. And so what he set out to do with the presidency was personalize it all the time, starting with the State of the Union speech. You know, it's now a big deal when the president comes every year to deliver the State of the Union. The president had not done that in 112 years. The last president to address the Congress in person was John Adams. And then it stopped as soon as Jefferson came in office. The dirty secret is apparently, telling a tale out of school, but apparently Jefferson had a lisp. And he was very self-conscious and didn't like to speak in public. And so every president thereafter never showed up. But Wilson brought this speech back. Whenever Wilson had an important legislative measure to introduce, he would call a joint session of Congress. And he would show up, give a speech, discuss the measure, and then he'd leave. But then he did something crazy. And this is something the Congress had never seen. He'd show up the next day, and there is a little office. There's a room in the Congress. It's the most beautiful room in the Congress. It's about 15 by 15 feet. Very tall ceiling, decorated in the most beautiful Italianate tiles. And it's called the President's Room. There is only one president who has ever used this room. And it was Woodrow Wilson.
Is that right?
It just sits there. It's, in fact, it's locked most of the time. Wilson used it for the purpose that Washington asked for this room to be built, and that was so that the president could come down and work with the Congress. Because Wilson, this great scholar, believed that the executive branch and the legislative branch should cooperate. And I mean that.
That's crazy.
I mean that. I know, but listen to that word. He believed they should cooperate the government, that the two branches are meant to work together. That's what the Constitution suggested, according to Woodrow. And so that's what he did. So he would show up in this room, sometimes four or five times a week, and he would just grab senators and come on in, sit down, let's have a talk about this. Sometimes, and he was a schoolmaster, don't forget. Mm-hmm. So he was giving them lectures, on what the Constitution said and what this law was about. And he was enormously effective because he created a dialogue. Mm-hmm. And this is where I think our current president sometimes fails. And I wrote an op-ed in March on this subject. basically saying you don't have to lurch from crisis to crisis if you have an ongoing conversation with your lawmakers, even if they're against you. They at least know you, mm-hmm. and that makes a big difference.
Mm-hmm. Wilson's from the South, mm-hmm. and two salient points about that. I guess one, as you point out, he's the first, only American president ever to grow up in a country that had been defeated in a war.
Correct.
In effect, and he understood the ravages of the war. It also left him with some, what would we would regard, I think, today as some fairly shaky views on race. Was he a racist? How do you evaluate his record as president when it comes to race relations?
Yeah, this is tricky. First of all, because it's a touchy issue, and second of all, here we are a century later. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to make a statement, I think, and then I'm going to go back on that statement. But if you ask me, was he a racist in 2013? Yes, Woodrow Wilson was definitely a racist. If you look at his statements, I think whatever century they were spoken in, they are racist. He did, upon meeting someone, I think to a degree, judge that person by the color of his skin rather than by the content of his character. Mm-hmm. He went in with a prejudice. Now, if you were to ask anybody in 1913, is Woodrow Wilson a racist? I think the answer 95% of the time would be no. He was rather a centrist. And I think you have to remember, this was a moment in which members of the Senate and the Supreme Court, several of them were members of the Ku Klux Klan. Mm-hmm. And not in a hidden way, they were rather proud of it. I mean, this was a badge of courage, you know, for these men. Wilson, all that being said, and here's where we've really got to parse everything and kind of tear them apart a bit. Wilson did introduce Jim Crow to Washington, D.C., which was then a small southern town. Wilson did not invent segregation. He, however, did segregate the Treasury Department and the Post Office. That's right. And in doing that, that, of course, sanctioned segregation anywhere that any state wanted to do as much. I truly believe, and I studied this more than anything else in putting the book together, because it's so regressive for such a progressive person. I was trying to figure out where it came from. But Wilson, gosh, he just felt the time wasn't right for the races to integrate. He felt that the few instances where there had been some integration, there were riots breaking out, there was just too much physical violence. He didn't want that on his watch. He didn't think the country was ready. He said, I think it'll take another generation, probably two, before America is ready to integrate. And, well, he got that calendar pretty right. I mean, it's really the mid-50s where mm-hmm. it can break loose again. On the other hand, did Wilson slow down that progress by segregating Washington? You can make a good and easy argument to say, yes, he did. Mm-hmm. I don't think there was hatred behind any of Wilson's moves, but I think, as I said, it was regressive behavior. Mm-hmm. And the black vote in 1912 went for Woodrow Wilson. They really put all their eggs in that basket. They thought, you know, rather the way Nixon was the one who could go to China, they thought we need a Southerner, really, who can bring blacks into the nation. And they pinned their hopes on Wilson, and he really let them down.
They were very disappointed in him.
Very disappointed. And yet, Wilson always kept the door open to black leaders. When they came to see him, invariably, they were rather charmed by him. And one of the greatest, the greatest really black writer of that period, a man named James Weldon Johnson, wrote of his meeting with Woodrow Wilson, and he walked in just loathing him. And he walked out, as he wrote in his diary, saying, I have to get over my prejudice of Woodrow Wilson. You know. So Wilson, I think he was decent, but I think he was ultimately wrongheaded. Mm-hmm. So yes, he was a racist.
Okay, short answer.
Yeah.
safe to say, he also had a bit of a mixed record when it comes to Supreme Court appointments. He named James McReynolds, who is truly one of the awful justices in American history. John Clark, who I think served fairly briefly without much distinction, and of course, yes. Brandeis, generally regarded as one of the great justices. He was a lawyer, he seemed to not have a terribly steady hand when it came to judicial appointments. Is there any explanation for that?
He had, yes, I think the explanation is his first appointment, McReynolds, who had started out life as kind of a trust-busting lawyer, and Wilson had appointed him as his attorney general. It was very shortly after the first meeting that they realized that Attorney General McReynolds was one of the prickliest characters who ever happened, to put it politely. He was a nightmare. He was a horror show. He was a total bigot. And he was on the court for decades. And so when there was the first vacancy, Wilson thought, I can't just fire him from the cabinet, but maybe I can elevate him to the court. So he did. He did put him on the court, and Wilson regretted it forever. And everybody on the court regretted it because he really was a horror show on the court, as evidenced by Wilson's third appointment, which was Brandeis, which was a very controversial appointment. Louis Brandeis was the first Jew put on the court. And it was scandalous. And there have really been only two great hearings for Supreme Court justices. One was Clarence Thomas, but the first, even harder one, was Louis Brandeis. And it was all about all sorts of things, but it was really anti-Semitism. It was just about Brandeis being a Jew. It was that simple. And Wilson really stuck up for him. But to go to McReynolds for a second, whenever Brandeis spoke on the Supreme Court, McReynolds would just pick up his newspaper and just and every year, of course, they take the team photo of the Supreme Court, and so long as Brandeis was on the court, McReynolds would not appear in the photograph. And also, whenever a justice retired, all the justices would write a farewell letter and they would all sign it. When Brandeis resigned, everybody signed except McReynolds. This was not a good guy.
You know, he was not a nice colleague.
He was bad news. Yeah. So Wilson had a spotty record on appointments, but in the end, he did give the country Brandeis, who truly was one of the great legal minds in the history of this country and one of the great liberal forces, certainly, on the court.
Mm-hmm. I want to pause and switch direction just for a moment here and talk a little bit about your writing, your approach and method. We had asked Scott whether he wanted to read here this evening, and he opted not to, which means I'm going to read something from your book instead.
Okay.
There is one paragraph that I just think you all need to hear if you haven't read it already. This appears in the book. This is the description of Wilson sitting down to write the address to Congress in which he's going to ask for a declaration of war against Germany. And it reads as follows. On Friday, March 30th, Woodrow Wilson was ready to prepare his remarks to Congress. He knew his next public utterance would alter the world. For this momentous address, he summoned the country's most successful speechwriter, one of its foremost historians, one of its first political scientists, one of its most elegant wordsmiths, a spiritual thinker to provide moral grounding, and finally, his most trusted stenographer to get it all down on paper. There, in his second-story study, Woodrow Wilson sat alone. Okay. Now you get what I'm talking about, right? I just wonder. I have to ask, and I'm going to take notes as you answer. Did that come to you in a moment? Was that in your first draft of this book? Did you hone that? How did that come to be?
That was in a first draft. Thank you. That's a favorite moment in my book, for me even.
It reads like you had fun writing.
Well, it sort of tickled me. Yeah. And I was reminded of... It's a ripoff, you know, which is, you know, there was the famous speech that JFK gave that I presume Theodore Sorensen wrote, when Nobel, I think it was at the Nobel
the
Prize
Nobel laureates,
winners,
I think, who, yeah.
Yes, the Nobel laureates come to the White House, and JFK said, using Sorensen's words, that this was the greatest assembly of minds since Thomas Jefferson dined alone. And as I was researching that speech, which is the most important speech in Wilson's career,
sure,
and maybe the most important foreign policy speech in American history, since our foreign policy to this day goes back to that one speech, I was noticing, my God, there's Woodrow Wilson's shorthand version of the speech, the very first draft. And then I thought, yeah, and he was this great historian. He was our first political scientist. And I thought, oh, well, there, I've got it right there. So that paragraph reads exactly as I wrote it the first time. It's one of the few paragraphs that I did not rewrite 14 times.
Very good. Well, you're wise not to.
Yeah, thank you.
The second one, and then we'll get back to the Wilson story here. There's a great opening chapter of the book where you describe Wilson's the great triumph of the victory in World War One, of course, and this really traces his voyage to Europe to mark the victory. And it's this long scene of the departure, the voyage, the tour of Europe. I love the detail that 2 million people turned out in Paris for him at a time when only 1 million people lived in Paris. Same sort of real question I had for you as a writer of that. Did you always imagine the book opening? This is chronologically something that takes place much closer to the end of the story, really, than the beginning. I wonder if you always imagined opening with that, or if you worked with different scenes, or how you ended up with this as the opening.
I always thought, almost from the beginning of my work on this book, I thought I wanted to open the book that way, with a big splashy opening. Mm-hmm. I really wanted a big thing for a couple of reasons. One is, most people don't really know who Woodrow Wilson is. And for those who do, they have a lot of misperceptions. So what I wanted to do as people open page one of the book was understand that this was, in this moment, the greatest man on earth. And that this was the first truly international celebrity, that he was referred to as the savior of the world. Now, I wanted to make a contemporary audience understand in a few pages the magnificence of this character in that moment. And I wanted to build him up, 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 because as inevitably happens with great heroes, they are going to have a huge fall. And I think, like most heroes, Wilson was a truly tragic hero. Mm-hmm. So I thought the more dramatic, the bigger I could make that initial impression, the greater the drama will be in the end. I also wanted to use it as a device just to give the reader, because it's a big book. And I think authors of big books should give the reader, before the reader takes off on this great journey, I think the author owes the reader something of a road map. And I wanted to give a map of where this book's going to go. And I wanted to give the reader the opportunity to pick it up in a bookstore and say, you know what? I'm not really interested in this. but I hope that I can hook you, because you're going to see this is going to happen, this is going to happen. You're going to see there are going to be two love stories. You're going to see higher education got changed. You're going to see, and you're going to get a little Whitman sampler while we're taking that first voyage. And so that's where that came from. And that was always in my mind. That got rewritten a lot because I really wanted to condense it.
Compress it in. We're going to turn to all of you in just a couple minutes, so get your questions ready. But let me just ask a few more that sort of carry us to the end of the presidency and his life here. One of the pieces I took great note in was his role in the Espionage Act. The Espionage Act, for those of you who don't know, really continues to haunt our politics today. Certainly, if you're a working journalist in this country, it does. It's the basis upon which the Bush and actually increasingly Obama administrations have waged these campaigns against leakers, and it happened to pass in the Wilson years.
That's right.
Why Wilson, such a believer in transparency and open government, what led him to endorse and sign the Espionage Act?
Well, I'll tell you what I think it was. As we were going to war in 1917, First of all, the country had never gone to war like this. This was really walking onto the international stage. The world had changed drastically. And for the first time, we were dealing with international terrorism. There were anarchists, there were communists. We didn't quite, you know, communism was brand new at this point, in world politics. And there was a period in which there were a lot of assassinations around the world, and there were bombings. There were mailings of bombings to a lot of senators, business leaders, there were a few incidents in which the bombs were not discovered, actually, and people died or were maimed because of it. But there was clearly this terrorism that knew no boundaries. I don't want to sound glib, but it really was an Al-Qaeda moment in 1917. And Wilson's feeling was, okay, we've got this in the background, and now I am about to send 2 million men possibly off to their deaths in war. I am clamping down. And so we are going to have some serious restrictions in this country. When it came to journalism, he had a very good relationship with the press. Wilson was the first president, in fact, to hold press conferences. This simply wasn't done before. And Wilson, as you pointed out, believed in transparency. And so he did have them. And so, by and large, he entrusted the press to censor themselves. But they did to some extent, because they knew that if they didn't, Wilson would come down on them. It's not good. He squelched a lot of free speech in this country, most notably Eugene Debs, the great socialist figure who gave a speech that was deemed seditious, and he went to jail for several years. And Wilson was given several opportunities to pardon him, and he refused. He simply wouldn't do it.
Right up to his last day in office, really. Yeah.
Literally up to the last day. And in fact, almost at the last day, some of the people who put Debs in jail, and the speech Debs gave, if you look at it today, it's like, okay, I'm looking for the sedition. I'm not finding it yet. You know, he was basically telling people they didn't have to serve in the army if they didn't. Well, that was it. Mm-hmm. But Wilson would have no part of that while young men were shedding blood for America. It was that simple. And shortly before his term of office ended, the people who had put him in jail came to Wilson. They had the pardon all written up, and they said, you know, Mr. President, Debs is old now, he is sick, he has served several years in prison. All you have to do is initial this now. And where his initials should have gone, he wrote denied, and that was that. And Warren Harding, Wilson's successor, one of his very first acts in office as a real slap in the face to Wilson was to let Debs out of jail.
Of all people, Warren Harding's the soft-hearted one.
Of course, and the Republican, you know, to let the socialist out of prison.
Right.
This was crazy, you know. But it was a real way to smack down Wilson, who frankly deserved to be smacked down on that.
The last big fight of Wilson's life, of course, is the League and the Treaty of Versailles. In a tragic story, obviously, in some ways. I guess the two questions I would have for you are sort of, how did he handle that episode, and how would life have been different if he had succeeded in creating the League?
Well, he handled it, I guess, in the end, badly, because he didn't get what he wanted, which is a League of Nations. Wilson led us into the war because he believed America could draft the peace, and part of that peace he had 14 points, and the 14th was a League of Nations, where discrepancies around the world could be settled before they blossomed into war. Wilson couldn't sell the Senate on it, largely because by then they were very Republican, and they disliked anything Wilson liked, if you can imagine. And so Wilson took the cause to the people. And he went on this tour and tried to sell it around the country. And in the middle of this 29 city exhausting to her. He collapsed and days later suffered a stroke. So he never got his league. He could have compromised up until the 11th hour. Even his worst enemies offered him a couple of really minor compromises. And this is Wilson's greatest strength and his biggest weakness. He would not budge. He said it is all or nothing, and he got nothing. Mm-hmm. It was that simple. How would the world have been different? I don't really do tea leaf history, but let's give him the benefit of the doubt. Let's say we got that League of Nations. Wilson believed, let me put it this way, Wilson believed that had there been a League of Nations in 1914, there would not have been World War I. Mm-hmm. Because what really began as a relatively minor incident, it was an assassination of a crown prince, but had the heads of all those nations, those kings and emperors and their statesmen, gone to a table in that first month, rather than posturing around, that war probably could have been averted. And so Wilson thought the Second World War would be averted, because he did say, while he was lobbying for his league, he said, if we don't have this League of Nations, there will be another world war within 25 years. And if you get out your calendar, mm-hmm. he got that one right, too. I mean, mm-hmm. he's almost to the minute on that mm-hmm. one. So that's it. I mean, I like to think, because I'm a believer, I'm an idealist, I like to believe maybe it could have worked. Mm-hmm.
Well, I have 1,000 more questions for you, but I don't want to hog you. I know many of you have questions, too. Do we want to take a few from all of you? And there are microphones coming, so I think the big question...
Well, we ain't heard nothing yet. Those were great.
Please, yeah, right here. Yeah, thank you.
You started out by saying that Wilson is sort of in the descendants right now. And so why do you think that's occurring? And since we've got Mr. Newton on the stage and he's done a biography of Eisenhower, do you think that Eisenhower's reputation among scholars and the public is on the ascendancy, and why is that?
Well, I'll take Eisenhower first.
I'll take Eisenhower. What are you talking about?
Because, and this is actually part of the answer about Wilson, and I, well, this is a very immodest answer, which is why I'll answer for you. But I think honestly, a large part of it has to do with the biographer you get. And I think a large part of the reason why Eisenhower is in ascendancy is because of very level-headed biographies such as Jim's on Eisenhower. I mean, I read that book, and it was just sort of mind-boggling. I thought I knew a lot about Eisenhower. I'd certainly read a lot of books. But I saw Eisenhower through totally different eyes reading that book. Jim made so much sense of the things we all went after Eisenhower for, like not being active enough against McCarthy or integration and those sort of things. In the case of Wilson, you know, I look at the other presidents of the century, and they've really been blessed, gifted with wonderful biographers. I mean, Teddy Roosevelt, who's this wonderful character, no question about it. And as I suggested, I think he's a bogus president. But he's had biographers who really made juicy books out of his life. And he was a juicy character. They should have. And the same with FDR and JFK and LBJ. And, you know, I mean, they're exciting books. And I think largely because Wilson was an academician, I think most people who have written about him are academicians, and the books are really boring. And you get this impression of a very dusty soul. And I just felt that is not who Woodrow Wilson was. And I think you'll see that in the book. I mean, he was a really juicy character. Mm-hmm. And so I think that is a big part of the reason. Now, there's a more historical reason, too. I do think that by the latter part of the 20th century, I think Wilson's racism was looking ugly, especially as the country was finally dealing with race in a big and proper way. And make no mistake about it, I still think we are a racist country, and we have hardly eradicated the problem. But certainly for a good 50 years, we've addressed it, and we've made some major, major shifts. And so then you read some of what Wilson did and said, and it looks pretty archaic. So I think that has held him back. And the sedition laws that we talked about, too. I think that looks awfully funny in the 21st century. So my job there is never to excuse him, but to try to explain him and at least build the context, at least show you what the world was like in 1913.
And I'd just one very small point with respect to Eisenhower. I won't presume on Wilson, but the nature of Eisenhower's leadership was indirection, the so-called hidden hand presidency, so that the declassification and release of papers related to the Eisenhower presidency has allowed a much more complete view of him now than was available in the 60s and 70s. So I think as we've learned more about him, he's looked back. He's also benefited by a series of successors who are fairly disappointing, as we all know. So,
that is true, yeah.
Next over here, yes.
I was just wondering, well before the incidents you mentioned and the failure of the Treaty of Versailles, is there something in Wilson's makeup that caused him to act in a way which, when he sent the peace delegation over, four Democrats and one Republican, the trip around the October appeal, after Pueblo, I understand the situation he was in, but did this man want the treaty to fail in a strange way that I certainly
I'm sorry, understand. Did this man what?
Want the Treaty of Versailles to fail, because he seemed to set up a situation where knowing one-third plus one of the Senate could defeat it, he seemed to agitate the Republicans intentionally.
No, absolutely no way did he want it to fail. No, he gave his life for it to succeed, no question about it. He went over to Paris. He took a commission of five, as you suggested, four of them were Democrats, and he took one Republican who was something of a token Republican. I think Wilson's thinking was that he was about to go over, walk into this huge den of lions with 24 countries, each of whom was out to grab as much territory and treasure as they could. And Wilson figured, I am going to have to be dealing with all these people. I need a supportive team. I can't have some opposition along with me who's going to make it hard for me. So I think that was largely his thinking in not taking some more prominent Republicans. In terms of going around the country, though, and his refusing to compromise, this for me is the most moving moment in Wilson's life. I hope it's an extremely moving one in the book. And that is, just as the treaty is finished in Paris, they're just putting on the finishing touches. It's the end of May of 1919. And Memorial Day, Wilson goes to the American cemetery in Paris. And they're just graves, graves, graves. And Wilson gives a speech that is, I it's one of the few times I lost it as a writer, and I was just crying, sitting, writing about this speech, in which he talks about how he basically condemned all these men to their deaths, and how he takes full responsibility for their deaths. How about that for a president? And that in coming home, he was going to bring this peace, and even if it killed him, how could he do any less? Because those 110,000 soldiers died for this cause, so too must he, if that's what it takes. And so, no, he gave every ounce of his being for the success of that treaty, because he truly believed its success could mean they had just fought what we called the war to end all wars.
Right.
It's a little offbeat, but given the concussion thing in football, in your opinion, did Woodrow Wilson save college football from being banned?
Did he save it from being banned? Yeah, he did. Woodrow Wilson, yes. You must be a rugby player. were you a rugby or football? Yeah. Because Woodrow Wilson, you know, the grim Woodrow Wilson, but he really was one of the major proponents of football. It was more like rugby back then when he was a Princeton professor and president. He really introduced football big time into college sports, and he had a lot to do with its existing today. I mean, there's no question about it. So, yes, he was very, very big on that. Yeah. He was not a great athlete himself, but he loved sports. Although I should add, he played more golf than any president in history. 1,200 rounds of golf. They say Eisenhower played 800.
And I think Clinton, somewhere between 8 and 12.
Yeah, exactly. But Wilson, I mean, Wilson played in the winter. The Secret Service would take the golf balls and paint them red so that he could play in the snow.
Way up in the back there.
Hi, you've talked about Wilson's record, civil liberties record, particularly with regard to the Espionage Act. And there's an aspect of his record with civil liberties that fell out of the story and recently came back in. And that is the arrest and then force feeding, jailing and force feeding of the suffragists that picketed the White House. And I'm wondering if you could talk a bit about Wilson's thoughts and actions with regard to women's suffrage.
I can. I'm glad you asked that. And you're speaking particularly of Alice Paul, who was a great feminist leader. And she was really sort of the left wing of the suffragist movement. And indeed, she was taken away and she was force-fed. And all those things are true. Now, there's always a story behind it, you know. Wilson, in fact, was not against women's suffrage. He was always for it. He believed, however, it should be state by state and it shouldn't necessarily be a federal amendment to the Constitution. Now, a lot of that is hiding behind the skirts, needless to say. It's the old civil rights argument as well. Now, when it came to Alice Paul, she was a bit of a showboat, in fact. And when she was sent off to prison, Wilson immediately said, pardon her, everything, let her go, we don't want her in jail. And Alice Paul refused to leave. And they offered Alice Paul food and this and that, and she refused to eat. She went on a hunger strike. And the government went to several doctors and said, well, what do you do with patients in asylums, for example, you know, when they don't eat? And they say, well, we force feed them. And, you know, there's a specific diet and there's a way to do it and this and that. And Alice Paul subjected herself to that largely to make headlines. Now, there's nothing wrong with wanting to make headlines, because she was making headlines for the cause. I mean, this was a good form of protest in a way. Wilson, shortly after we got into the war, really had a complete turnabout on women's suffrage, because he saw the role women were playing on the home front. And he said, how can we really be fighting for liberty around the world when we're not even giving that to half the electorate in this, or half the population in this country? And Wilson, on a dime, just turned and became an extremely vocal proponent of women's suffrage and a constitutional amendment. And the likes of Alice Paul, even, came around to applaud Woodrow Wilson. So Wilson was not there early. He sort of got it in the middle, and he came on hard in the end. And he really was, up until its passage, the last year and a half or so, a genuine champion. He really did twist arms on behalf of women's suffrage. I have a lot in the book on this, in fact. And it's really interesting to break down the movement. And it's quite interesting, actually. It struck me, in the end, was more of an issue about generations than genders, I began to see. It's a lot like the gay rights movement today. And that is, you know, the older people simply, you know, Mrs. Woodrow Wilson did not think women should have the vote. Mrs. Theodore Roosevelt did not think women should have the vote. But the daughters of all those people thought they should. It was unquestionable. And indeed, the sons did. So it really took another generation to get it. And that is ultimately what happened. But so in that regard, Wilson was one beat ahead of the curve, I would say.
We have time, I think, for two more. So maybe one here and then one over there. Great.
In your introduction, or perhaps it was your introduction, you described Woodrow Wilson as the most influential president of the 20th or possibly 21st century in terms of foreign policy. But you've just touched on that a little bit, perhaps about his bringing the United States more fully into the world stage. What other ways was he so influential in shaping our foreign policy?
And I was trying to get your attention. Let's be fair. But I do believe it. And this was something else, too, when I was putting the book together. I was just thinking, and it goes right up to today, almost any headline in the paper, no matter what the subject, somehow can be traced back to Wilson. But now to give you some specifics. Foreign policy. I mean, Barack Obama's speech last week, talking about Syria, should America be the policeman of the world? What is our moral responsibility when we see 1,000 people being gassed and children dying? Can America, mighty America, just sit there? And well, this, he was channeling Woodrow. I mean, it was almost verbatim from Woodrow Wilson's speeches 100 years ago. Almost verbatim. So every foreign policy decision in this country, I would say, since April 2nd, 1917, when Wilson said the world must be made safe for democracy, goes right back to that speech. So that, I think, is the biggest thing. So whenever we are debating Afghanistan or Iraq or Syria, these are purely Wilsonian questions, to say nothing of the fact that Syria is a country that Woodrow Wilson drew on a map. I mean, the modern map of the world was designed in 1919 by four men on a map so big that they literally had this map on the floor. And imagine the four greatest leaders of the world are on their knees on the floor drawing lines saying this is Iraq and this will be Jordan. And they created this world. So that internationally. On the domestic front, I would say for the last 100 years, the foundation of our economy has been the Federal Reserve System, which was the second great act that Wilson introduced as president. He did it in his first year in office. He basically created the Federal Reserve, which is very much with us. The 8-hour workday, workman's compensation, bringing Jews into the government. Those things, for example, the way the president functions, you know, this way I was talking of giving the State of the Union speech, these things, creating a more powerful executive branch, those are all Wilsonian. Women getting the vote. I mean, the women's rights movement really has lift off the moment Woodrow Wilson signs on saying it's time women get to vote. So even communism, which has now come and gone, really goes right back to Wilson. That's when it really first was inflamed in this country. So those are 8 or 9 of the reasons.
One more. Yes, sir.
You mentioned the men on their knees drawing the map. How was Wilson perceived by Clemenceau and Lloyd George? I have the impression that they saw him as a kind of naive fool.
I think you're correct. Clemenceau of France and Lloyd George of England did perceive Wilson as a kind of naive fool. They thought, oh, this will be a cakewalk for us. Now, Wilson was not naive, and he was not a fool. He knew everything that was going on. There are a lot of imperfections in the treaty, as even Wilson admitted. And I've come to a philosophy that is, there's not an answer for every question. And there's not a perfect answer, let me put it that way. So that when Wilson went over to deal with these two dozen nations, to carve up the world and to decide what the reparations were and so forth, there was no single definitive answer. There were 24 countries, each fighting for himself. There was only one exception, and that was the United States. We didn't go over with a personal agenda. We went over with an international agenda. And Wilson basically tried to do everything he could to advance that agenda. Where he may have erred was in basically making concessions here and there, more than he should have, perhaps, so that he could get his League of Nations. And he believed that if we had the League, even with these other imperfections, the League can iron that stuff out over the next few years. But let's get the League in place. Let's at least have it up and running. And then when these things, you know, because he made some really bad calls when it came to China, for example. And that could be ironed out, he thought. But Wilson knew what was going on. The French and the British didn't think he knew what was going on, but he saw it. But they had him at a great disadvantage also because these talks took place in France. So Clemenceau, you know, just could walk back to his office and still run his country. He knew Wilson had come across an ocean and was going to be there for 6 months. And Wilson finally just said, I've got to get home. Let's just wrap this thing up. And that's where he really began to make concessions in the end, when it was really time to get home. So I think he did the best he could.
So we're about to wrap up here. Let me just leave you with a thought, if I may. All of you, I suspect, are lovers of history and know full well that there are two kinds of history books that you read. There are those you have to and those you love to. I'm here to tell you that with Wilson, you get both. This is it's a book that's essential to understanding American history, and it is a pure joy to read. So my recommendation to you is to get out in the lobby, get yourself a copy, get Scott to sign it, and hurry home, because you'll love it.
Thank you. That's funny. Thank you very much.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.